You're listening to the Illustration Hour podcast, an interview podcast where I talk to illustrators, art directors, and agents about the craft and business of illustration. My name is Julia Dufossé, and I'm an editorial and commercial illustrator based in Chicago. And I'm chatting with creatives within the world of illustration to learn about their process, the challenges they faced along the way, and how to succeed as an illustrator today. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Illustration Hour. I'm your host, Julia Dufossé. This week is a little different. I'm really happy to bring you an episode with Matthew LeBaron. Matthew is the founder of Much Creative, which is an agency that represents talented artists and creatives. You can find out more about Matthew and Much Creative on the agency's website, muchpresents.com, or on Instagram, at muchpresents. So after studying illustration at SVA and FTI, Matthew discovered a love for representing artists and changed his career path from becoming an illustrator to becoming a rep. He has over a decade of experience working with and representing artists and illustrators and has a real passion for helping illustrators. More recently, Matthew launched Collab Plus, an innovative portal that allows creatives to look for one-off project management, negotiation, and contract overview help. And that also helps buyers find qualified creatives to fit their budget and needs. So needless to say that Matthew knows a lot about illustration, what it's like to work with clients as a freelancer today, and how to protect yourself and ensure you get paid adequately for your services. And Matthew generously offered to answer some audience-submitted questions for this episode. So thanks to all of you who submitted questions. We talk about a lot in this episode, and it's honestly a conversation that's filled with just great information about the illustration industry and the business of freelancing. Matthew talks about negotiation, usage rights, quoting, pricing, client communication, representation, self-promotion, and many other topics that are incredibly important for any illustrator. And he shared a lot of examples of things you can do to get more work, promote yourself, and reach out to clients. I also found this conversation refreshing because Matthew has a totally different perspective on things like Instagram and self-promotion. He has had the luxury of seeing many creatives and to learn what works and what doesn't. Matthew was so open with sharing all this knowledge. It's like your very own private consultation with a rep with years of experience working in the industry. So grab a cup of tea or coffee, grab some paper to take notes, and please welcome Matthew LeBaron to the show. Matthew, thanks so much for being on the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. There's not a lot about you online, actually.
Success.
As I was doing research for the show, I noticed that you're quite discreet and private online. I would like to know more about how you got to where you are and sort of like your background. I know that you actually enjoy drawing and maybe even thought about being an illustrator for a while before you started working with illustrators. So, tell me a little bit more about that.
Oh, yeah, happy to. I've been drawing, painting, creating stuff since I was about 4 or 5 years old. Grew up with a pretty creative family in a gown shop that my grandmother and my mother owned, and found a love for drawing really early on before I knew what illustration was. And as I went through high school, turned out I had a knack for it and really enjoyed the process and, you know, learning various styles. And so I decided to go to art school, which included building a portfolio and going to portfolio shows at those schools and having them rip your work apart.
Yeah.
And lucked out and ended up getting into SVA for the illustration program back in 1999.
Which is a great school. Yeah.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to it. You know, grew up reading about, you know, Basquiat and the Warhol movement and Keith Haring and just New York in general, and SVA really being considered like a pretty up there Harvard of art schools.
Yes.
And settled into New York at 17, turning 18, and had my first year. Was a little rough to settle in, and at the end of the day, just realized I wasn't quite ready for school and the bills that come along with college.
Yeah.
So I took a few years off and decided to just live in New York and waited tables, bartended.
Which is expensive. Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's, you know, it's interesting. It's not as, it wasn't as expensive back then as it is now. And I hate to be that, you know, old man screaming at clouds.
I mean, it's true. The prices have definitely risen
really
a lot.
It's really difficult for artists to live in New York now.
Yeah. Now it's become almost impossible for anybody without, you know, a full-time job that pays very well to live in New York proper.
Yeah. And so I guess I lucked out in that sense that I caught the tail end of affordable New York and waited tables and worked in the service industry, did some bike messengering, lots of different jobs. And then I'd say around like 21, 22, started to feel settled and like it was time to go back. And I found the Fashion Institute of Technology. And they really offer a fantastic program for illustrators. It's a state school, so it's around, or was around, $8,000 a year if for a state resident.
Which is much more affordable than SVA.
Oh, much more affordable.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the program there was really revolved around art and how to create art, but also how to create a living being an artist. And they focused heavily on, you know, what it takes once you step foot out of school, which I really valued. I think it was like maybe our second or second year that they started really honing in on, okay, what are you going to do when you leave here? And I found that really interesting because at least when I went, it wasn't really mentioned in the curriculum at SVA. And a lot of artists I've met since who've gone to various colleges said they left really not knowing, like, what do I do next? And I left FIT with a really good sense of where I wanted to go.
But you thought you were still going to be, you know, you were going to be an illustrator at the time when you left FIT?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. About a year before I was going to graduate, I missed a very important meeting for reasons I will not elaborate on. But I missed a really important meeting that basically said you either want to stay in the day program or get moved into their night program because those last 2 years actually got more full. So I ended up getting switched into night classes. And anyone who waits tables in New York knows waiting tables during the day is not profitable.
Okay. Yeah, I see.
I had to find a day job, which was terrifying. But at the time, I had a really great partner that was an art director at Entertainment Weekly. And he said, you know, I saw a listing for an art assistant at a rep agency. And
So you went that route. Yeah.
And at school,
what does an art assistant really, really do? I always kind of wondered that.
When I started, an art assistant for the agency that I worked at the time, Bernstein and Andreuli, they needed someone who could help collate all the art, help create portfolios. This is when websites became much more prevalent. So it was, you know, they needed like the young tech guy to like, you know, figure out how to use the web and do all these other things. Yeah. And so, I really just put my energy to use there, being like, you know, if they told me to make a photocopy, I made three of the best photocopies.
So it's kind of a job where you are like a jack of all trades and you're handling a lot of different things. Yeah.
Yeah. And I took it because I thought, well, what a better way to learn how to be a freelance illustrator than sit next to reps who are doing this. Although a lot of schools tell you like reps are like absolutely evil. At my interview, I made it clear to them. I said, I'm really interested in this art position, but I have absolutely no interest in becoming a rep. And they still hired me.
Yeah. That's interesting. So how many years did you work there?
Well, I worked there through my graduation and then stayed on after graduation because
A full-time kind of position.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. I had health insurance. It was great. Because while I was working there, I had the opportunity to help produce a few jobs. And the one thing I realized was I lacked the temperament to take client feedback. I was great at school and critiques, but when I heard clients tell an artist to do something that was against all of their rules of concept and, you know, composition and color because they are the client. I was like, wow, I don't think I can do this. And the few jobs that I took on while I was still in school, I ran into that problem.
Was it because you took it too personally? Or
I think it was because I took it too personally. And I felt that, you know, if I disagreed with the client, they should be looking to me for my expertise as an artist and follow my lead. But that's just not how it is. And at the end of the day, as Yuko Shimizu puts it, they're paying you to create something for them. And, you know, they have final say in most terms.
Yeah. I think it's a service. So you have to.
Yeah. It's difficult to do that. And I think some of the best artists I've worked with who handle that, they have crafty ways of letting the client think they're dictating what's happening, but they deep down really are. And it's just, I noticed that it wasn't really a skill that I had. And I also learned that I really love producing jobs with artists, like helping them manage the project and helping them figure out how to price it and helping the client understand the process, which is a huge part of what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you stayed in that position for how long after?
Oh, man. So I stayed on for 2 more years as an art assistant, and then I got promoted to a junior rep.
Uh-huh.
And was
so given, you became a rep. What you
I
said
became
you
a rep
want.
At the end of the day. And I was given the opportunity to grow the CGI division after a few years of working with illustrators and animators. And that's where I really found an area that I once hated and found a hidden love for. Mm-hmm. At that time was like around when Avatar came out. And I look at that as a pinnacle of like CGI just changed after that.
That became
a much different field where things, like the process to create CG became faster. Mm-hmm. And there were new programs were coming out. I believe that's when like early stages Cinema 4D or 3D Studio Max, something along those lines, it changed. And I started discovering these really amazing artists who brought illustration and CG together to create a visual language that was pretty new to the field of freelance illustration.
Mm-hmm. I can definitely see that in the artists that that Much Creative, the agency that you have now, represents. You have a lot of artists who are using, like, it looks like they're using Cinema 4D and illustration in a way that's really interesting.
Yeah, totally. It definitely has become something that we are, or I am more known for. But yeah, a few people know that like for about 4 years, I was strictly an illustration rep and dealt with pencils and colors and Adobe Illustrator artists. And and that was what I focused on in my career as a young illustrator too. So it was an easy access point for me to help and understand other artists that I was repping at the time.
Yeah. So let's go back to when you were repping at what's the name of the place? I forgot.
Bernstein and Andreoli.
Oh yeah, okay. And so after that, what happened? Like
I was at B&A for roughly 12, a little over 12 years.
Wow, yeah. Long
and
time.
I think in this business you start to get to a point where you can continue to work for somebody else and make great money and meet good artists and really help people grow their careers and have wonderful relationships. But I started to get that entrepreneurial itch. Mm. You know, there's certain ways that I wanted to do things. I call it my Jerry Maguire moment because at BA, I was really working with and had access to over 60 amazing artists, 20 some odd different studios and motion studios. And I just, after a while, realized I missed having that closer connection with some of my clients.
Mm.
And it was really, in a way, a chance for me to build an agency that I felt could get back to that. Really get back to working with an artist, not only on bringing in jobs, but helping them manage their career, like how to navigate Instagram, figure out, my style's shifting. Is this a good or a bad thing? How do I navigate that?
Really a more personal relationship with them.
And a lot of artists also get to a point where they're individuals and then they become so busy and they start to think, well, maybe I'll bring somebody on. And does that mean I'm now a studio or am I still an individual who flexes when I need to? And being able to really work with artists in that capacity was a main driver for this.
Yeah, because it sounds like the first reason why you got into the industry was also because you really love the process of creating art.
I do.
Too.
Yeah.
So that would really make sense with that being the case. So how did you, I mean, it's so, I could think of a way where it would be very intimidating to create your own agency, especially when you've been in like a full-time position at a big place like this and you have a lot of access to a lot of things. So how did you go about like really creating your own agency at the time?
Well, I had and still have, and I'm very fortunate to extremely encouraging partner who, you know, I talked over this plan with many times, as well as a few friends and colleagues and peers who also encouraged me. So I can't say it was just me taking that leap on my
right,
own.
Yeah.
And I value that. That assistance that I got from those friends and family members. But I think after a while, you just start to have this idea so many times in your head. And whether you're right or not, you start to convince yourself it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only hear that little voice in your head so much until you have to actually just take that leap and do it.
Yeah, well, but some people don't. I mean, the risk involved and, you know, it can be quite scary. But
the other risk was happiness. You know, like I wanted to be happy and doing what I was doing again. So I think it was the risk of being unhappy in my current like kind of role where I felt like I kind of hit a ceiling. My happiness was just worth more than the risk involved in starting my own company.
Yeah, that's something I can absolutely empathize with. I think that's something that a lot of people who are starting to freelance or even starting to like illustrate can empathize with.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
It's just like there's a lot of risk, but there's also the risk of not being happy, of not doing what makes you happy. That's I think it's much greater. But yeah, so you created Much Creative. How long did it take to create that agency? And in the beginning, was it just you as a rep, or did you have other reps? Or
yeah, so you know, it's a tricky business because you don't want to. Really put yourself in a position of getting sued by your employer. So, you know, there are non-competes and certain things you have
to
wait.
You mean by artists or?
Oh, no, by like, you know, if you're at an agency, you're almost always going to be under a non-compete.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you mean like the process of transferring to your own agency?
Oh, yeah. So I took some time off and, you know, got all the like legal documents together of forming an LLC and started talking to other artists. It was really important to me not to move too fast or too slow, you know?
Yeah.
So I started talking with artists, and some of the first artists that I started speaking with, I met at Us by Night, which is a huge conference, festival, nighttime bazaar that happens in Belgium annually, run by Rizan Perrine. And it's a great way to meet artists.
Why Belgium? Why did you...
You know, Rizan Perrine was one of the first artists that I took on as an individual rep at B&A, and he put this nighttime festival together that just sounded amazing 4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And he's thrown it every year, and I've gone every year, and he has wonderful speakers in the illustration, CG motion, marketing, advertising world, all speaking. There's food, there's games. It's a very like discussion-focused event, even outside of the talks that are given. And you get to meet a lot of artists that you follow. Like I got to meet David McLeod and Luke Choice of Velvet Spectrum, Voltron, all these great, amazing artists that are out there. And they're all here in one place in Europe. So you get time to chat with people and started talking about what I was planning and was fortunate enough to take on some really brilliant talent.
And including in that, you just mentioned Rizan Perrine, who did... Yeah, I think he did the Drive.
Yes.
Because what he does is these kind of 3D neon signs.
That's one aspect of his
typography.
Work. Yeah, and that was a huge piece for him. If you ever get the chance, I think he's given quite a few interviews on it. It was a huge turning point for him. It was a self-made project that he just wanted to do, and it just took off overnight.
Oh, you mean he did that before he actually, or you mean he took on that project without an agent or?
It was just a self-initiated project. He wanted to do a neon and he did it.
Okay.
It wasn't even for a client. He just did a a personal project, which is a huge thing I talk about with artists.
Yeah.
Always asking, what do I do when I don't have work?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And since then, he's done a lot of stuff. Like, he's worked
with
huge clients. Yeah. I think he even worked with Jay-Z. I mean, he's done a lot of projects that are like, you know, would be a dream for a lot of creatives.
Yeah. I mean, and he became a trendsetter within the CG world during that time and continues to, and now has expanded into this festival that he throws. And I believe he's in LA this week talking about that festival, actually.
Okay. Yeah. I'd never heard of it before, but I really admire his work. So I'll definitely like look into that whole thing. Yeah.
Definitely worth looking into Us by Night.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So let's get back to you creating Much Creative. In the beginning, you made sure you had all your duck in a row and, you know, all that stuff, all the legal things that come with being an agent. But did you envision having a few reps in the agency or just yourself?
No, I knew I'd have to start off with myself. I think when you're building an agency, it's all about culture. And I need to make sure that like the artists that I work with from the beginning all get the experience I want them to get, because at the end of the day, it is a service that we offer. And I say we, but I'm speaking about the royal we. It's just the company.
Yes, yeah.
But
no, I
want
get it.
Every artist that I work with to get the same experience with every project that gets managed by us. The same way I want the clients to get the same experience. So in order to do that, I had to start off with just myself.
Yeah.
And that's really a bit. The first year and a half was really just me.
Yeah. So now you have a few other reps working alongside with you?
Or? Yeah. Well, right now I have one other junior rep working with me a few days a week. He's not full time.
Uh-huh.
And then through our other channel, Collab Plus, we have a network of project managers and producers that we bring on for projects that are either a specialty of theirs, locality is oftentimes a reason, or if we just have too many things going on and I need help.
Yeah, yeah. So I was just going to talk about that. I really want to talk about that because I was intrigued by that idea, the Collab Plus idea. But can you tell me what it is and how it came to be, I
guess? Sure, absolutely. So when I did start the company and I was only representing a few artists, as anybody, whether you're a freelance illustrator or a new agency knows, it takes time to get your name out there. So during that process, I had a lot of people being referred to me for project management, and both clients at ad agencies would refer artists who maybe didn't have the experience to manage the project they brought to them. So they'd say, hey, you should reach out to Matthew. I know he started his own company. He's a great project manager. He might work with you on one-off things. And not a lot of reps do that. Usually if an artist would call an agency for help, they only work with artists in an exclusive capacity. So I thought, how can we offer project management to artists who might need the help without bogging them down with like an exclusive representation contract? And also, I can't do the exclusive representation contract for everybody. I don't have the time to give the full rep experience to every artist that includes career management, client relations, all those things we talked about.
Right.
Before.
Yeah, that's because that's a very holistic kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it takes time.
And so we started, and then we also said, well, if we're going to be doing these projects with these artists, it makes sense to have a section on our site where we say, hey, if our artists aren't right, we know a bunch of artists that we can vouch for because we've worked with them, and here they are. And that's how Collab started. And then Collab Plus is the evolution of that, where we added in a simple form that clients and artists can use if they need help. Clients from a resource side, because I love helping my clients, and a part of building relationships is letting people know that you're a resource. And sometimes clients will come to me, and if it fits for one of my artists, I'll gladly, you know, take that job on. If it doesn't, rather than just say no, I've worked in this industry long enough, I can say, hey, you should go to Art in Motion. They've got this great artist I know that would be perfect for this. Or maybe you should try Snyder or even BA, my previous company.
Yeah.
Because this is about, we are a community, you know, like the art community is so small in the grand scheme of things. And there's a lot of work out there. And so my feeling is, if my clients come to me and they have a project they need help with, they receive my help whether they work with me or not.
Yeah. And I think that's a great way to the handle that.
And from a universal perspective, not to sound too corny, I think it all just comes back to you too. Like whatever you put out there in the universe, like it's going to come back.
Yeah. I want to talk more about what you just said, which is that you talked about project management, and it occurred to me that sometimes I wonder what that means exactly for an artist. Like,
yeah.
So what does that really entail to help an artist with project management?
Yeah.
What are the sort of things that are under that umbrella, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, everything that I refer to in terms of project management from the perspective of a rep falls under the moment you take that creative call and guide the client and the artist through that call to negotiating the contracts and fees, to actually not just being in CC on an email, but, you know, stepping in when you need to. Let's say the client's over asking or the artist is under delivering. It's your responsibility as the rep and project manager to come in and say, okay, let's figure out where this is going wrong. Let's, you know, make sure that the artist is getting paid for overages. Let's make sure deadlines are getting met, you know. And then at the end of the day too, helping the artist figure out, okay, once this project is over and published, what do I do with it? Like, how do I promote this project properly? Where do I put it?
Okay.
Is this something that's good for my portfolio, or is this just something I need to pay the bills?
And is part of that also just smoothing out kind of like exchanges between the client and the artist? Because sometimes I know that can become not acrimonious, but
that's a good word for it.
Yeah.
No, I think you know, and again, having been an illustrator, I can tell you when someone comes back and says that they're unhappy, you can kind of go into panic mode and not respond the right way. And sometimes it does help to have me in the middle, going, you know, getting that feedback from the client and going back to the artist saying, hey, I think you're doing a great job. The client's happy with the project. There's a couple things that need to change. Yeah. Or vice versa, where the client's not giving the right feedback or it's coming in piecemeal, which is a huge issue these days.
Yeah.
Going to the client and saying, hey, we're really happy you guys are giving this concise feedback, but what we need you to do is consolidate that all into one email and give that to us at once so that we can keep the project moving smoothly. It's that ability to really like keep everything calm while really approaching conflict, you know, and really, you know, confronting certain conflicting issues within a project.
Yeah. And that's very hard to do for yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
You're also thinking about creating, and that takes up a lot of energy, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's basic conflict resolution, which I think as humans, we're not, a lot of us just don't like conflict. And you add, you know, a fee that's kind of up in the air, you know, like I think a lot of artists sometimes are like, don't want to say things that they should say because they're afraid of losing the job.
Yeah. Especially when you're, I think, starting out and you feel like,
sure.
Yeah. So I want to kind of get into the Q&A because we did ask people from the audience and from really from anywhere to kind of give us some questions that they have about the business of illustration and, you know, all kinds of things, representation, things that we've already touched on a little bit. But so one of the questions that was submitted was actually about the whole business of representation and what does an agent actually do, and why do people seek them out? You touched on this a little bit right now when you were talking about project management and the kind of things that are involved. But yeah, so what does an agent actually do?
I mean, it's a great question. And I think depending on which agency you talk to, their services are going to differ slightly, but at the base of it all is support. You know, a rep or agent, whichever you want to call them.
Is that the same thing or?
Yeah, they're the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the base of that relationship is support. And what you're doing is you're supporting an artist. And it's a mix of career management, client relations, project management. I'd also say sometimes I'm part therapist.
yeah.
You know, and really we're a partner. You know, an agent is someone that should be helping you elevate your career. And it's hard to say when someone should or should not seek out an agent. I have artists who've sought agents out at the beginning of their career.
Yeah.
And artists who've worked for you know, a number of years, made a name for themselves, and then they get so busy and, you know, they really want to focus on just creating the art that they pull on a rep to help them manage their inquiries and really kind of take on more of a producer, project manager role, whatever you want to call it, for them. Because imagine creating art all day and having projects on it. You don't want to stop and answer your emails or take these calls, which half the times are people kicking tires to get fees or clients that ghost you. The artist wants to focus on like making the art. So a lot of times the rep will really be there to just do that business aspect for them.
Yeah. And I think that part of why some people wait is also because, and this should be said, there is also, I guess, a con, if you might call that, of having an agent, which is that, you know, part of the money that you're going to make on a commission is going to go to the agent.
Yes.
And that percentage can vary greatly. And I guess also some people are afraid of getting a rep too early because they think the fee will be higher because.
Yeah, no, that's understandable. I also think it's important because a lot of young artists who either come straight out of school or in their first year will approach me. And it's not that I'm hesitant because of their experience. I'm a big fan of people going out and seeing what it's like to do what you are about to hire someone else to do for you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take 2-3 years and you go out and you make those cold calls to clients, you go to those presentations, you fumble around a little bit with your first estimate or two, you really see what it's like to do all of this, then you start to understand a little bit better what it is the rep's taking off your hands and doing for you that that percentage is paying for.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's giving you back time, which is also something that's going to make you money in the long run.
It's giving you back time. I think it's also giving you a little more confidence in when those inquiries come in, knowing that like, okay, this person who isn't me is going to ask for the right fee and stand their ground when I know. And again, I know this as a freelance illustrator, it's hard to stand your ground when someone's saying, well, no, we don't have that budget. You know, you want 5, but we have 4. And you go back and say, okay, I'll take the 4. But me as a rep, I'll go back and say, well, how about 4,500? Mm-hmm. You know, it's that ability to really manage every aspect without this fear in your head, which we all have.
Yeah. And so a lot of people who, I guess, start out with agents representing them, and I've heard quite a few people on the show mention that's how they got started, that they got represented by, you know, a big agency or smaller agency, and that they got clients through that. And that sounds almost like ideal an artist perspective, because, you know, but it's also something that I think about. I'm like, when you're starting out, how do you even go about securing an agent when you have, you know, almost zero commission work, and also how do you get the right agent, the agent that is actually going to get you jobs? And I think a lot of that probably comes down to your abilities and what the agent sees in you.
Absolutely.
But it seems to me that's where I kind of have, I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not agents actually want to represent people who are really starting out in that way.
Well, I think, and again, a good rep is going to have a great eye. You know, curation, not only for, you know, their agency and how they want to appear. And I always go back to Hugo and Marie for this. They have, I mean, you go to Hugo and Marie's site and you know exactly the kind of work they do, the kind of work they want, and the caliber of artists they rep. They are a shining example of taste and a taste level. I think any rep is going to see something in an artist. And even those artists who are starting out who may not have a ton of commissioned work, there's a style there. And knowing the market also is really important. And you know, if you know what's going on in the market and you kind of see a shift happening, and then all of a sudden you meet this artist who maybe they don't have a lot of experience, but their work is just utterly beautiful, really well done, and fits to where you see the market going, you know, that's a really good example of when a young, inexperienced talent might be taken on. Or an artist, you know, oftentimes show glimmers of what they're going to be as well in their work. And I always say it's like dating. So like, I never really take on an artist exclusively right from the jump. I always say, like, let's get to know each other. And I see something in an artist when I actually get to like talk to them and hear them talk about their work.
Yeah. Yeah. And so from the perspective of an artist, how do you know when you're starting out, should you be reaching out to agent, for example? Like, that's a question that I've had for myself, but also like I've heard people ask that question.
That's a great question. I think it really
because
comes
we don't have maybe that eye about our own work.
Right. No, I mean, God, we're the worst critics of our work.
Yeah.
So I would say when you have a portfolio of work and you see stuff that's out there in the world and you say to yourself, I can do that. I can do this. I want to do that. Or dare I say, I could do that and I could do it even better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when you're ready to get into it. You know, you're like, I have a passion to create work and tell stories visually. And I see the work out there and I know I can do this. I think, you know, that's got to be inside of you, this desire and this confidence that you can do this and you can make a living off of it and you want to try.
But concretely, would you recommend reaching out to people who work at agencies directly or?
That depends. I think if you can find an agency that, you know, you've seen other artists grow in. So, you know, you're like, oh, I saw Josh Cochran's work 10 years ago at this agency and I've seen his work everywhere and I've seen him grow since. Like I use him as an example because he's grown so much as an artist and, you know, he started somewhere just like everybody else. And if you see an agency that has artists like that, I think that's the right agency to go to.
Yeah.
If you have an agency where it's like all heavy hitters and it really seems like they're more talent management based on artists who are already
Succeed. Yeah.
That may not be the right agency to go for.
When you're starting out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause that just may not be their wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Cause look, that is one completely different area of artist representation too, is managing, you know, artists that are just starting out. There are some agencies that do that well and some that don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you reach out to agencies as you're starting out, are there things that you recommend people do? Or
absolutely.
Do you have to, for example, like one of the questions I have is, do you have to make a case for yourself, or do you just sort of say, here's my work, I'm starting out and I'm looking for representation?
That's a great question. And it's a question we get a lot. I would say the best answer is show yourself and do it in a concise and simple way. I think your work is going to speak volumes, and that's really what we're looking for, is the work. We obviously want to learn more about you and hear your backstory.
Yeah.
But I think it's just as important as when you reach out to potential clients, is knowing that like everybody's time is pretty limited. And
right.
At the end of the day, whether you write me a paragraph or, you know, a 6-page letter,
if
I'm
the work isn't there,
the
it's
link.
Not there.
Show me the work. And that's the best thing you could do, is just say, hey, I'm an artist. I love, you know, obviously like the work that, you know, I see on your site that you're representing. I think it's a good group that I would fit into. Here's my work. Can we arrange a call?
Yeah.
Really simple and straightforward.
Yeah. I think that one of the problems that people who are starting out might have is that they're maybe too hesitant or too almost like self, like derogatory in their first emails. Like maybe they're like just like circling it a little too much.
I've gotten a few of those. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just doesn't seem, it just doesn't inspire confidence. And
not at all.
Might not be the best way to approach a rep, even, because a rep still has to see potential in you that you feel confident about yourself also.
For sure. And let's be clear, artists, we're all different personalities. And I don't want people who are maybe a little more quiet or meek or maybe not the best self sellers to think, oh, well, I can't reach out to a rep. I don't know how to write that.
No.
That's not what we're saying. I think what's important here is to say that, like, you don't have to email someone and be like, hey, I'm a badass. My work's awesome. You should rep me. Actually, that would be an awful way to do it.
Yeah.
What I mean is just a simple approach of, here's what I do. I think I'd be a great fit for your agency, and I'd like you to check my work out. And if you're interested, let's talk.
Yeah. Do you care at all if people are making, you know, a case for why they're a perfect fit or?
No, not really.
No. Yeah.
Because that'll come clear on the call. And I usually like to do video calls too, because eye contact and body language is super important to me. And I almost always do a video call with someone I'm interested in representing personally.
Interesting. That's interesting. So another question I got through the Q&A is about when you select an agent, should you avoid being exclusive with that agent?
That's a really good question. And that is one of the hot topics of freelance work right now.
Yeah.
You hear it at a lot of festivals and talks like the Off Festivals and other industry events. It's tricky. So I think for a long time, exclusivity existed because agents would, this is pre-Instagram, pre-website, agents would like print portfolios and go out and hit the pavement and see clients. And I remember we would have appointments, 3 or 4 appointments a day when we would go to Chicago, and you're just back-to-back meetings, selling, showing your artist's work. And so the exclusivity—
So you would show everyone that you represented in a kind of way, or?
Usually you would bring a specific group of artists that you rep that were pertinent to that
yeah,
agency.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, and so the idea behind exclusivity is making sure that the artist gets, or the agent gets rewarded for the marketing work that they're doing for their artists. And I think as the websites and the internet became more prevalent, and now the, for better or worse, Instagram, it's really difficult to approach exclusivity because so many clients are finding artists on their own. And
yeah.
I mean, some reps are going to kill me for saying this, but I do think that our job has changed a bit. Like it's not about just getting the artist's work in front of clients. It's also about like finding the right fit, making sure clients know that these artists are capable of doing the job, and really helping them understand the process of the artist. So exclusivity is tricky. I think if you want one rep to sell your work in a certain region, say the US for instance,
yeah,
and they want exclusivity, I think it's important that they share a marketing plan with you so that you so that you know that they're selling you everywhere, right? Because exclusivity in the US is one thing, but that doesn't make sense if the agent's only based in New York and only really selling you directly to New York clients.
Yeah. So there are ways to, what you're saying is there are ways to limit that exclusivity.
Yeah. Yeah. The other flip side of that for agents that artists need to understand is if I'm doing, you know, email campaigns, LinkedIn research and outreach,
yeah,
cold calling and going to meetings, and I'm spreading that around to like all the major cities in the US that, you know, do advertising and have brands that would hire you, and I'm doing all that work and you want to bring another rep into the mix, the only way that'll work is if those two reps communicate and have like territories that they're going to go after.
Right.
Because otherwise, how does the rep get rewarded for the work of they're doing on the back end of pushing your work to clients for that sale and for that job?
Yeah. And one of the things that you hear now also is that, you know, you hear artists saying, you know, I get most of my work from Instagram. Why do I need an agent?
Yes, absolutely. I actually just had this conversation with somebody. I get most of my work through Instagram. Why do I need an agent?
Right.
So the only reason I think you would need an agent in that instance is if you need help with everything aside from getting your work out there.
Right.
And that goes back to the career management, client relations, project negotiations, billing, and promoting of the work. Now, interestingly enough, Instagram has become this way for clients to find artists. Only again, the flip side of that is not all the artists they find know how to actually produce a job with a client.
And because just getting a client to say, hey, I like your work, doesn't mean you're going to get work from them, you know?
And if you do, it doesn't mean you necessarily know how to do it. So I've had clients come to me and say, oh, I've got this project, I only have 2 weeks and I need some help. And why do you only have 2 weeks? Well, we worked with an artist we found on Instagram for the last 4 weeks. They missed a few deadlines. They didn't deliver what we needed. The format was all wrong. And I think that's the tricky part is someone can have like 20,000 followers and a really great style, but it doesn't mean they know how to produce art for commercial advertising or a brand.
And so since you mentioned Instagram, which is just a huge part of what illustrators are talking about now, another question that we got is about Instagram directly. And it was about, is Instagram really that important? And what your perspective is on Instagram, why does it matter what size following I have if my work is good? That
was
another question.
Really important question. And I'm glad you asked. So Instagram has created a really flat world. It's brought us all closer together. It's given access to artists who, you know, 10 or 15 years ago may have never been discovered. And it's a wonderful platform for sharing. The flip side of that, it's also created and commoditized the idea of a following. And if you think about it in terms of media buy, a media buy is what an ad agency puts together to say, hey, this is where we're going to put the work once we make it. So they'll buy a billboard or two, some space on the subway, some bus shelters, print ads, TV spots, etc. What they don't buy and what's not included in a media buy is what they get with an artist who has a large following who then posts that project. So let's say an artist has 200,000 followers and a client hires them to do a piece, and the artist shares that piece afterwards. On average, I think what's the stat is something like 25 to 30% of your following actually will see your feed or something like that. So that means they're getting an additional, you know, thousands of eyes on an ad without really having to pay for it.
Right.
And so that's because why the following matters.
They don't
to a
put
lot
that
of
in the contract that you have to share, or do they?
They do sometimes. And that was my next point. That's the other reason a following may be important for some artists, because the influencer era has really got brands all up in arms, and brands want quote unquote influencers.
Or micro influencers.
Or micro influencers. Yeah, yeah. And what they want, and the reason they want that is because if someone's got a huge following and they post that work, that's extra eyes on the work. And, you know, they have the whole, all the laws now with, I think it's the FCC, where it's like you have to put hashtag sponsored, hashtag ad. So people know that this is an ad and it's, you know, sponsored post if it is. But
yeah,
a lot of clients will ask at the beginning of a project, especially social agencies, you know, what's your artist following? You know, and will they be comfortable with posting this? Or here's the contract, the artist has to post this with this writing and these hashtags a number of three times, and then they have to do a story, and it's also part of like what they're purchasing is your following. And that's tricky for some artists also, because a lot of people follow you because they like your artwork and they don't want to be sold to. So I know a couple artists who don't do those projects because they're afraid of putting off their followers. They don't want their followers to, you know, think like they're a sellout, or that they, you know, are tricking them into seeing an ad when what they're really following that artist for is their artwork.
Mm-hmm. So in art, are you seeing that a lot now with, I guess, with clients? Are they, I guess, does it really matter if you have a huge following, but only decent work, or you know, vice versa?
Because that's a tough question to answer, because I don't want to disparage anybody with a huge following whose work I might find, you know, not as highly elevated as some others. But yes, there are artists out there who've got massive followings who are very good at the Instagram game, whose work may not be that high a quality. And it is frustrating for a lot of the artists in our industry. And I've had talks with, you know, with a lot of them about this. And it's frustrating for them to see that they're up against other artists for projects that may not be, that years ago would not have been in the mix. You know, it's just the quality and the caliber is not the same. And it has influenced a lot of clients' decision-making processes.
Do you find that clients actually come to you and ask, you know, or like, for example, they're thinking about hiring somebody, but then they change their minds because the following isn't big enough? Because I've heard little snippets of stories from people who are saying, you know, like, I got asked to like quote this person, and then they saw my following and they said it's not big enough or something, and
nobody's
and
had the audacity to say that to me directly. But I imagine if it's a campaign for a social project, like that's strictly on social media, that a client may say that and may tell you that. And I think that's just something you have to be aware of when working on a strictly social campaign, because
but for the majority of work that illustrators do, it shouldn't be such a big factor, you know.
You know, I can't say should or shouldn't, because I'm not on the agency side. I know that they have, you know, numbers and metrics that they need to hit as well. So I don't fault them for that. I know that as artists, I think it is a very tough pill to swallow if you find out that you lost a job because your following isn't bigger. And I get that. I mean, that is, it would be a very frustrating notion to entertain.
Yeah. It's the flip side of that is what you, would you recommend that artists do on Instagram, really? Like, should they focus on it? Should they invest time in sort of promoting themselves on Instagram? And, you know, how much of their time should be invested on, you know, Instagram as opposed to maybe their website or...
Right. First and foremost, your time should mostly be spent on honing your craft and making good work.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
When you're done doing that, I think, yes, you should focus on getting it out into the world. And right now, the best ways to do that are Instagram. Behance is still fairly popular. Mm-hmm. And, you know, creating like things offline, you know, like special print promos, buttons, things like of that nature, that like whatever you think is unique to you.
That's something you still recommend people do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's something we talk about a lot at Much. And because if you think about it, everybody's so inundated with emails and newsletters and Instagram and Behance.
Yeah.
When we send out print promos or little pieces of art, special things to clients, you know, they call us and they're like, oh, this is really nice to get this. You know, like we get so much email and our eyes are on these screens all the time. We do often hear that like clients still do like that. But to answer the question about Instagram, I think it's like anything, it's about a balance, because there are some artists who are so overly concerned with Instagram.
Yeah.
If they don't post something regularly, they start to get depressed and freak out and worry about losing followers, and then have those apps that tell you when you're losing followers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be a balance. I think posting work in progress, posting some, you know, personal projects is a really good idea. Posting some ads that you've done and having a nicely balanced Instagram, yes, I think is important.
Is it, but do you have hard and fast rules about, you know, like you should be posting this much time per week or, you know, like, is important?
I don't have that. I know some artists and some agents do. Uh-huh. But again, I think it's really about, you know, here's the problem with creating hard and fast rules like that. What happens if you get busy with projects and miss those rules?
Right. Yeah.
Then what do you
or ask? What happens if you're developing another side of your work and you're maybe not focused on posting that right away?
And the flip side to that too, you know, to be careful of, and I speak from experience, there are some really great artists that I work with who post a lot of R&D on their on their Instagram as a way of showing their work, and they get copied a lot.
Mm.
And clients put their work in decks and then go to other artists and say, hey, can you do this? And artists unfortunately say yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the other, the flip side and the, I guess the double-edged sort of Instagram is the inspiration versus just flat out copying.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but once you put your work out there, it's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good point. Yeah. And that's something that is unfortunate.
You know, it's important to say this out loud too. The only reason Instagram is what it is because we all participate in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if artists were really, you know, were like, hey, we're fed up with Instagram and banded together and said, you know what, we're not going to use this as a platform to show our work anymore. You know, the power is in their hands. You know, like artists, I think oftentimes forget, like, y'all are a community and, you know, you can talk and you can make decisions. And, you know, Instagram became what it is because of the content we as people put on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't have to be a thing. But it is. And again, I'm not disparaging Instagram. I'm just saying, like, you know, we create these trends and these things that we use. Like, it's almost like Facebook. Like, everybody hates Facebook. It complains about it, but everybody uses it.
Yeah. And that's very true.
You know, like, we don't have to use it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think part of it is, like, it can be a really convenient way to get clients, especially.
Oh, it's a great way to get clients. Yeah. It's a wonderful way to, it's a great platform. But like anything, you know, if you find yourself in bed at night scrolling through Instagram at 1 a.m. when you should be sleeping, or during the day when you should be working on your craft.
And having just massive anxiety about it.
Right. That means it's becoming a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the questions that we had was about, it's about promotion, but it's really, the question is, do you take on work when a client says, you can't promote it after, or you can't share it?
Promotional embargoes.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is, again, you're bringing up all the best topics of conversation in our industry right now. There are a few brands that have promotional embargoes on their projects. And
can you say why they do that in the first place?
Yeah, I can give a little bit of insight. Unfortunately, like, I've had really great discussions with some of these brands, but have signed some NDAs about not being super specific. But I can tell you this. So
yeah.
Some of the brands are so large that it's very difficult for them to change contracts. And because they started off as a product-based company, anything that's made for them is considered part of their product. And they need to have control on how that stuff is promoted. That said, some of those companies are changing those rules slowly but surely and doing the best they can to accommodate. I would say that if someone's coming to you and they have a project that you really want to do, but they say that you can't promote it afterwards, you could do one of two things. You can say yes and bite the bullet and just not promote it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously you can say no, but the other thing you could do is you could put in a line item fee for the promotional embargo. And you can make the argument like this, and this is a fair argument. The work that I create for you is work that I then use to get more work for myself as a freelance artist. If I can't promote the work that I'm creating, I then can't build more awareness around the work I'm doing and therefore bring in more work. Granted, it's only one project, so it may not be the end of the world, but it's a slippery slope. You know, if you start letting people tell you you can or can't promote the work you're doing, how do you get more work?
Yeah. So you're saying there is a cost to this.
There can be. Yeah.
Yeah. And is that something that can work?
What do you mean?
Like saying that and coming back to a client and saying, you know, fine, I can't, you know, you're saying I can't promote this afterwards, but there's going to be a cost associated with that.
It has and hasn't worked for us. Clients have said, well, we're not going to pay that. And we've said, okay, well, we're not going to take the job on. And that's when you just got to let it go and move on.
Yeah.
And then clients have said, you know what? That makes sense. We understand. Maybe they can't afford the whole fee you put in there. And they say, well, we can offer this. And at least that's like a middle ground. At least they seem like they're trying.
Yeah.
And I think that shows a certain level of respect for the issue you're bringing up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to fault clients for having that issue without doing ask the client, say, hey, why is this? Don't be afraid to say, hey, why is this in the contract?
Yeah.
Oftentimes they're happy to discuss it and understand your frustration with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's a really important point about just negotiation in general, is that asking, can we discuss this particular thing in the contract or can we discuss this? It's not going to make the client not want to work with you.
Not at all.
Right.
Not at all. I understand why some artists are hesitant to say that because they're like, if I make a fuss at all, I might not get this job. But understand that like we're all in a business and it's a professional environment. And if a client does give you shit for asking to explain something, they're probably not a good client.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be great to work with them.
Yeah, stand your ground. I mean, that's what I've made a good reputation for as a rep is I stand up for my talent and it's important to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think there's also just the idea that from an artist's perspective, like, do I have to be like ruthless or like, you know, like it's kind of like a bluffing game or, you know, it can become kind of unclear.
Like who will flinch first?
Yeah. Like it can become unclear, like what you should do. And like, oh, like some people will tell you, you know, say no right away because then it shows that you're not going to, you know, it's just like, it's a whole mess that you don't necessarily want to talk or think about as an artist.
Well, I'll say this, and I hate to like, you know, pare it down so easily, but if you play games, you're going to be in a game.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't really think it's about bluffing or trying to play mind games and saying no first off, because if a client comes to you and has a great project with a good fee and a good contract, say no. I think it is about
stupid.
Like treat people the way you'd want to be treated, you know, and there's nothing wrong with asking questions and standing up for yourself. If someone's coming to you and saying, this is our contract and it's non-negotiable, I don't think oftentimes they're trying to pull one over on you. I think it's because they know that within their company and their culture and their rules, they're not allowed to negotiate. These are their contracts. I know, you know, some major food and healthcare brands are like that. And the agencies that do work with them have to adhere to those contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I also think try not to get too emotional about it. That's when things get tricky. If you start to get too emotional, especially when it comes to like negotiating and just contract stuff, because your emotions can play tricks on you.
Yeah.
And you can say and do stuff that, you know, can put you in a not so good position to negotiate.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important.
Which is hard. We're all emotional people, especially artists.
Yeah.
Like, this is your craft. So I get it. I don't say that lightly, but yeah. I think that's why sometimes reps can be very helpful is, we're not about getting overly emotional. You know, we want to make sure, we keep a clear head.
I want to talk more about usage rights mm-hmm. and that whole kind of topic, because it's a big topic for illustrators. And it's also something that when you're starting out, you don't necessarily know about usage rights, or like, I guess that's a thing that you can ask for, for limited usage rights.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've seen a lot is that clients now, they seem to be reaching out to illustrators and just asking for rights in perpetuity.
Yes.
By default.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, myself included, when you're starting out, the very beginning, you don't know that you can even negotiate on that, or that, you know, you don't have to accept rights to your work in perpetuity from the get-go, I guess.
Yeah. You know, and so that's a couple of different topics there within a topic. So usage is, you know, just to be clear for the listeners, it's basically where the work that you're creating is going to live and for how long. And you should always have that in writing, and the client should know where that's going to go. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, that's usually when the buyout thing happens, or the company's so large, they know that once it hits their content stream, like say a Coca-Cola, for instance, it's going to hit so many different parts of their agency or their company, they can't keep track of it. So for them, buyout makes more sense.
Okay.
I will say this though. I feel like buyout has become a pretty lazy ask. It's just an easy thing to tell your client, to tell your brand as like the agency, oh, we got a buyout for this. They think, you know, they feel like they got a lot for their money. But a client should know that even if you get buyout, unless it's actually being put everywhere, that doesn't really, you're not getting a lot. You know, you're just getting the ability to use it. It has to still be used.
Yeah.
But yeah, buyout is become a lot more of a standard ask. Mm-hmm. And
well, the one thing is that it doesn't necessarily come with paying more.
No, it doesn't. And it should.
Right. Yeah.
Because if you think about it in the grand scheme of things, like, again, I'll just go back to the Coca-Cola reference, something, a brand that's that big, a buyout means like that could go on. It could go on their product. It could go in their pop-up stores. It could go in point of sale at every retailer. It could go on their social media, their website. It could be made into t-shirts. I mean, there's a number of different ways that somebody can use your artwork when they have a buyout.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to, you know, understand. And again, going back to our topic of ask questions, sometimes just asking, hey, I noticed that you asked for a buyout, but I'm curious, do you really need that? Or do you have a specific area that you're going to be using this in? And can we change the language to reflect that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it's just a standard because people don't want to bother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's one of the questions that we got about usage rights specifically was, are there scenarios when you shouldn't, as an artist, charge an additional fee for usage rights?
Not that I know of.
Right.
Again, unless the client comes back and says, well, we don't normally pay usage, you know, we all bundle it into one fee, then just mm-hmm. put whatever usage fee you would have put in there into the larger fee. I think usage should always be considered. I'm trying to think of an instance, maybe for a nonprofit.
Yeah.
You know, if you're doing, you know, work for a nonprofit that, you know, doesn't have an insanely large budget, but would need to use something everywhere, and it's a project that's like really close to your heart, maybe. But even then, I think it's always good to have the usage outlined.
Yeah. I think that becomes a problem when you're starting out or when you're not as experienced. And that goes into another question that we've gotten that is more about how do you approach quoting when you have no idea how much to charge. And I guess to tack on to that, I have a question more about whether you think it's a good idea to give different options, because I know some people will, you know, quote different packages
that
include different usage rights or different like amounts of rounds of revisions. So what's your general kind of like
advice? Good questions again. So general guidelines is each artist, I would say, has like their own way of pricing things, but the market, after you work in this industry for a while, you realize what some pretty standard market rates are. Mm-hmm. And I try to adhere to those always and explain that to clients when quoting. That's a really good point. Whenever you send a quote, just make it clear to clients that like you are quoting a market rate, your market rate, and that you are open to negotiation. Like that's another way to open up the door to like discussion rather than just like, well, this is my price, take it or leave it. Which I know artists are oftentimes scared to do, and for the right reason. Like there's no reason everything can't be a discussion. And just know what your baselines are. I think when you're first starting out and you're trying to figure out pricing, think about the amount of time you're gonna spend on it, as well mm-hmm. as the time you spent learning how to do this and the amount of use you're gonna be giving.
Yeah.
Because that's a big thing that's been around our industry for quite some time. A big notion is like, well, if it only takes me like a few hours to do this illustration, should I be charging X? And I forget who originally quoted this, but they said, you know, you're not just paying for the art you're getting from me right now. You're paying for all the hours of research and development I do, all the time I spend honing my craft. Like you're paying for the whole package.
Yeah.
And that's part of like hiring me as an artist, is you're getting like my experience as well. And that mm-hmm. that's worth something.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think it's a good idea to quote like different, I guess, price points? I've seen a lot of people
recommend this.
Yeah, where you say like, okay, so for this amount, you get, you know, limited usage rights and blah, blah, blah. And then for this amount, you get more usage rights. For this amount, you get rights in perpetuity. And that amount is way, you know, larger or something.
Yes, I think that's fair. Clients often ask for that. So
they do.
They can show the brand. Different, we call it like an a la carte menu of pricing.
And right,
that's
yeah.
become more prevalent over the, like since 2008, 2009, when the market took a huge dip, the crash as it's called.
Is it something that puts you in a better position?
I don't know. I think it shows flexibility and I think it shows your willingness to negotiate, which isn't a bad position to be in. I know that some clients, won't ask for that, but I can sometimes get a sense that they're budget conscious. So what I'll do is, if they're asking me for, you know, they're like, oh, are clients interested in creating an image, and they may be interested in creating more if they can afford it, then I would usually show like the cost difference between one and then give them a price break for five. You know, because it shows the client one that your willingness to, you know, give them a deal on more work. But also the way to make that work for you too is to say like, well, these are all going to get done at the same time in a compressed time frame that you can't go over, so that you get to create that work in a time frame that makes it still feel like you're getting the value for your work.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the questions that was directly related to this kind of question is that somebody said, I noticed a disturbing trend where clients ask how much you charge for work without providing enough information about the project and without telling you their budget. So what would you answer in those situations? I've actually gotten those emails too.
Yeah.
It's quite common, I think. It's like and often what will happen is the person will actually ghost you afterwards, where they, when you answer, you know, like, let's talk more about budget, but I need to know more about the project. They'll actually ghost you.
Sorry to bring this all back to dating again, but I do find this whole world very much like dating. Replace the word budget with, you know, what are your interests and where would you like to go on a date? Like, why would somebody ask that unless they actually wanted to go on a date with you? I do believe that like the same thing can, you know, pertain to work. If someone's coming to me and asking what we charge for something, my first questions are for them is, what's your brief and do you have a project? If not, come back when you do. Now, I will preface that by saying I do have clients that I've worked with for years, or people I've pitched on projects with for years, who will come to me and they're like, hey, I'm trying to put something together for my client so that we can figure out how much something's going to cost and, you know, put our budgeting together, and I'm not well versed in this. And in that instance, I'll say, sure. First, is this something you think might be good for one of my artists, or are you just needing my help with like putting numbers together for a project?
Yeah.
And that's the difference. Like, it's one thing to ask me as a rep. It's another thing, I feel, to go to an artist when you don't have a project for them, you may not ever have a project for them, and just kind of like what one of my old colleagues calls kicking tires. You know,
right.
Like when you go to the you go to a car shop and you're just like, oh, what's this one cost? What's that one cost? And you're not really intention of buying.
Yeah.
Do your
Do you
research,
think that's generally like, what's happening when somebody is asking, you know, what's your what? How much do you charge for one illustration? Like, I don't know.
I think what they're trying to do is figure out the most affordable way to hire you for a project. So they, I do think most of the time they have a project for you. However, mm-hmm. I do find that like smaller agencies and brands direct will call me before they even have a project, and they're trying to figure out what they can afford to do. I always say this, like, come up with your concept, call me when you have that, and I'll help you figure out a way to get our artists to do it within a budget.
Because you can't
right? like, make
really
it a relationship,
quote them not, anything yeah. on
right.
if you don't
and you
have
shouldn't.
Any idea.
And you shouldn't.
Okay.
Because they might come back to you and say, well, here's my brief, and you told me months ago this would cost X, but the brief doesn't really like reflect what I said, and I told you when you called that these were just general numbers. Like, it's hard. When you start giving people numbers and quotes without a brief, they oftentimes will hold you to it, and it can just get very tricky. I always say when a client calls asking for numbers, it's fine to be like, oh, is this for a project you have for me? And if so, can I see the brief? That'll help me get a better number.
So that's what you would recommend answering in those situations.
Yeah.
Not necessarily quoting a very general number.
No, and definitely not giving hourly rates. That's a weird question we get a lot from clients, because usually that comes from motion studios who are trying to hire artists to do style frames or come in and help them pitch a deck. They'll ask for hourly rates, which I think is totally fine and appropriate. But when an agency or a brand comes to you with a project and they're like, hey, what's your hourly?
Yeah.
Steer clear of that, because you can't say, you don't know, this job may take you more time than most. It may be more labor, maybe more email communications and phone calls. So to give an hourly is just really odd to me.
So would you say, I don't typically work on an hourly rate basis?
Yes.
And then say like,
yeah.
Yeah. So that's what you would generally
Yeah,
advise.
I would just say, you know, I don't really work on a day hourly rate. If you wanted to quote on a project, I could definitely do that. We work on project fees.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because we get that question a lot.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure you do. It's a problem, I think, to think in terms of hourly rate, especially for things like illustration, because that devalues the work a lot, I feel.
Well, and also a client should understand, hey, if you really want me to be on the clock, like, I'll put in an hourly rate and I will charge you for every hour that I work on this project. And that includes phone calls with you, emails with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Explaining my process. Like, and I think at the end of the day, just tell a client, it's going to cost you a lot more money working with me on an hourly rate than it would to do a project rate.
Yeah. If you charge like a lawyer does, for example.
Yeah. I mean, and they do it like, I think it's, if they're on the phone with you, it's per hour. So anything over like, the half hour mark counts for an hour, and anything under a half hour counts for half of that time, or something like that. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I have one of the questions that I had, which was related to fee erosion, was how can we collectively and individually fight against fee erosion as illustrators? And how can we educate commissioners of illustration about appropriate fees for our work to improve rates throughout the industry? That's something that I've seen a lot on Twitter, for example, people getting upset about contests, competitions, things like that people perceive as devaluing or eroding fees.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we are stuck in the age of triple bidding. Agencies only used to do this, I think, for much larger scale projects like
what does
car
that mean?
Commercials. But now I think almost always you can ask when a client comes to you, am I bidding against anybody else on this project? Usually because of like cost consultants and cost issues, a lot of agencies have to triple bid a project, meaning that they have to get three artists to bid on it, and they won't tell the artists what each one is bidding on it. And you end up really not knowing what's what, and they won't give you a budget. And that is one thing that I think that has contributed to fee erosion. Is you know, just the agencies need to bring fees down and look better to their brands, their clients. The other thing is, you know, if you see another artist's work in a brief that you're getting, mm-hmm. it's fine to say, hey, have you approached this artist for this job? And if they say yes, they weren't available, sometimes you can assume that that really means yes, but they were too expensive.
Uh-huh.
And oftentimes they're looking for someone to do it cheaper, mm-hmm. or they haven't done the diligence and found the actual artist. But you know, fee erosion is really, I go back to my thing about Instagram. It's really, we're a community. So I keep hearing this thing about fee erosion with artists, but if we all talk to each other and all kind of band together and say, hey, this is this, and I'm not going to say yes to this, and I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not going to agree to this unless it's, you know, this market rate that we've all agreed on, that would definitely help. But at the end of the day, you have to also understand there are artists out there and people who like sometimes like have rent to pay or have a new kid, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know, have a sick family member and need to take on jobs at lower than market rates. So it's a lot to ask people to always do market rate work. And so I guess short answer is I'm not sure how to fix rate erosion, but mm-hmm. I do know how to fix client education. And that's up to mm-hmm. all of us. When we take a job on, even if it's for a lower rate, make sure the client knows, hey, I'm happy to do this job because you've explained this is your budget. And, you know, I definitely want the work and sometimes need the work. But just so you know, normally this would cost X.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay to say that. I mean, a client shouldn't get mad at you for saying that. I mean, you're just uh-huh. making sure that they understand that they're getting a good deal and that in the future, should they come back to you, you would appreciate them actually hiring you for your market rate.
Uh-huh. What about people who say, they're hiring you and not paying you maybe market rates, but they're offering you exposure?
Oh my God. I have a question for you. Can you pay your rent with exposure?
No.
Ask the client cannot. That. You know,
yeah,
and
I can't.
And I know that sounds like a smart ass answer. And yes, exposure is important. It does help you get jobs, you know, in theoretically. Uh-huh. But I get frustrated with clients who start off conversations like that uh-huh. rather than honestly say, hey, we just really don't have a huge budget and we want you to do this job. Mm-hmm. And part of that is we'll make sure we push this, you know, really big, but don't sell it as though exposure is like a replacement for a fee, because it's not.
Yeah.
And you know, it's an unfair thing to put to an artist and a freelancer is to say, we don't have the money, we know we should pay you, but we give you exposure. You wouldn't go to a plumber and say, hey, I need you to fix my toilet, but I only have half the money you would normally charge. So why don't I'll give you great exposure on my Instagram and tell people that you did such a great job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a tough thing to swallow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm pretty adamant about that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. And a lot of people are, it's a weird way to pay somebody.
And it's a weird thing to replace money with, like with, you know, compensation. It's a tough one.
Yeah. What do you usually tell artists when they say, when they ask you, how do I get more work? Because that's a question that I got asked a lot throughout this Q&A.
It's a conversation I have with artists and all year round, the artists I rep and artists I talk to. So, you know, there's a number of ways for you to get work. If you have a rep, make sure you're giving them new work to promote you with all the time, weekly or biweekly, monthly at worst. Make sure you and your rep or you alone are coming up with like inventive ways to market yourself to clients, both digitally and, you know, through actual physical promotion.
Mm-hmm. What about if you don't have a rep?
And if you don't have a rep, I think you need to really sit down and think about, you know, how can you stand out in a pretty crowded field? Mm-hmm. Are you, you know, making calls, cold calls to clients, potential clients that you want to work with and, you know, making sure you touch base with people to show them your book? Emailing is great, but sometimes a phone call can just be helpful so that, like, you know, a client knows to look in their inbox for you because they could have, you know, 40 artist submissions in a day. Mm-hmm. And if they have to, you know, look through all those versus like doing the work that they're at their job to do, it can sometimes be tough to keep up. And I think some art directors, creatives, art producers will also say, don't ever call me too. Don't take that with a grain of salt. Like, calling is like 50-50. But, you know, emailing, doing some form of a newsletter, making sure you're doing your Instagram stuff, keeping up at industry events, going out and networking, constantly updating your portfolio, whether that's the website, Behance or whatever. And, you know, really making sure people know you're around.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the best way to get work.
So you recommend direct kind of an outreach, even if you're working by yourself and you don't have
I do. And I recommend like honing that skill as well. Mm. You know, play it off a few friends, see what they think of this, you know, email you put together. Make sure it's not too long. Make sure it doesn't sound super casual, but also like super professional either, because that can be like a little stifling. We're in the creative field. Be creative with how you reach out to clients. I think that, you know, personal outreach and cold calling or cold emailing is important.
Yeah, I've never done cold calls. That sounds...
Oh, it's so nerve-wracking.
Yeah, that sounds
I know
scary.
It is super scary.
Yeah. And it sounds also a little bit outdated almost.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, picture like that's an argument that can definitely be made. But cold emailing and things like that aren't outdated, I don't believe. And I think that it's still important you do that. Calling's tough because a lot of times people don't want to answer the phone. They don't have time for a conversation. Uh-huh. But then at the same time, I also hear from clients who are like, I don't have time to check these emails and I don't have time. Uh-huh. So you have to figure out like, how are you going to get somebody's attention?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And do you think that there are tricks to that, or do you think that there's just a basic way of doing it that, you know, you just have to hone? Because I think a lot of people try to find a way to kind of trick somebody into seeing them. And that can be dangerous too.
It can be super dangerous. Number one, I will say, stay out of people's DMs. Leave people alone on social media.
Yeah.
Instagram, I would say.
Really?
Like,
and that's kind of interesting because I see a lot of people also saying like, oh, totally DM someone, you know.
Well, companies I think are fine. So if you're like, oh, I really like this agency, and you DM them and say, how do I get my work in front of your creative department? Uh-huh. That's one thing. I think I've learned a lesson of like, if I like reach out to an art director on Instagram, they do get a little weirded out. For some of them, it's the very personal platform and they don't want work to be like in there and being like kind of reached out to on that personal level. Some I've heard say it's okay and that they're fine with it, but I think it's, since it is so 50-50, I just try to stay out of DMs on Instagram.
Yeah.
Unless
there
it's
is
an
a
agency.
Connotation with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think in terms of tricks, again, if you play games, you're going to get games. So rather than say tricks, I think come up with formulas and professional ways of doing things that work for you. If you notice like you got a certain response from somebody from doing something differently, try that way instead of mixing it up all the time. Go with what works, what you see like the biggest rate of return on.
Yeah. So definitely like just experiment with different things.
Yeah. Enter awards, enter award shows, enter festival competitions. Mm-hmm. You know, those things are still really important. And a lot of clients do find artists work through those. Go to talks, go to things like Off and really, you know, and network. Use your network of other artists. I always highly recommend getting a mentor. You know, if there's an artist that you really believe in and love the trajectory of their work and their career, don't be afraid to reach out and say, hey, could I take you out to coffee and kind of ask you how you did what you did and get some insight into this world that I'm breaking into.
Yeah. Is there, I heard you recommend before like sending actual physical things to people you want to work with. Is that something that you would definitely count as a good kind of?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm struggling with my environmental awareness as well. So like, I will say that like we are trying to find promos that we can do on recycled products that, you know, are low emission in terms of like delivery. So there is that struggle. But yeah, I mean, people love getting a piece of artwork. You know, if you have like do a limited edition print of your work on like a postcard size and like sign the back of it or put a personal note with it. I mean, that's still, I know I sound like an old man, but I still think that people, and I've heard from clients that they do like getting that. Some people do special like promotions where they'll send out, I want to say Jelly did this. A friend of mine over at Jelly told me they did send out like 6-packs to clients with like a cool bottle opener that they made with their artist. Yeah. You know, some people do like small little notebooks with art on it that, because we also like the age of the notebook has come back. People use physical notebooks again.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they'll do newspapers or one-off prints that fold into like a mechanical that, you know, shows a really cool way of showing your work and can be used for something else. Clients love utilitarian things like calendars and
things they can actually use.
Things they can use that they don't feel like they're just going to throw away. And I, you know, I don't, at the risk of sounding old, I will say it. I don't think print's dead. And I think print is amazing. And we love seeing our work.
Oh, I don't think anybody who works in illustration should operate with the print is dead philosophy, because that's sad.
It's just untrue, you know, like the print's not dead. And if anything, I think the screen time we've spent now is just forcing our hands in to have something in them. And we want to take our eyes off these screens.
Is there, this is sort of a question that I've asked myself throughout the years, and I know a lot of artists ask themselves, when you reach out and you say you're cold emailing art directors or creative directors at different agencies, and you hear nothing, do you follow up with them?
So I take a pretty classic kind of approach in any form of sales. Mm-hmm. If I haven't heard from somebody after 3 outreach points, I usually just let it go.
Okay, so you do try 3 times though.
Yeah, so I'll do an email usually to introduce myself. I'll follow up with a phone call if I feel like it's somebody that would benefit from knowing our work. And then I might give another email a shot or send them one of our prints via mail. And I keep track of all that, especially for my artists, because I like to give them a report of what we're doing.
Yeah.
But I'm of the mind too, though, I don't sell plumbing supplies. I have artists that I know are amazing and that my clients would benefit from working with. So I like to think that I'm not bothering them with those 3 points of contact. I'm just trying to make them aware of work and artists that I think would do well within their agency and be a good fit for the content that they're making.
But I think that's a good point. But I think a lot of artists struggle with feeling that, you know, they have, it's almost like they need permission to reach out to people, or confirmation that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, I would say this for anybody feeling that way, we're all in the same, we're all in one industry together, you know, and clients who hire, I think there is an expectation that they're going to be approached by artists and reps, and it's just part of the business. And I know it can feel strange to reach out to somebody that you don't know and almost seemingly begging for work.
Yeah.
But it's also, it is just part of what we do, is making people aware your work is important. And yes, there's a fine line between outreach and harassment. And I think you know when you get there, you know, like I said, 2 or 3 touch points. Someone hasn't reached out to you. They're either too busy, the work didn't resonate, or, you know, it's just not meant to be.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said for resilience. And you know, don't let, look, I've been in marketing days where I set aside and do calls or emails, and after 100 different emails, no one gets back to me. You just can't give up. It is what it is. It's just part of what we do.
Yeah. Well, I think we're close to the end of our time, but I wanted to transition quickly into a question that I generally ask people on the show, and that is if you could give one piece of advice to, I guess in this case, illustrators or creatives starting out today, what would it be?
Continue to evolve. Don't ever be afraid of trying something new. And continue to just do what you started doing that got you into this industry, which is making art. Art is a huge form of happiness, both for you and for the people who see it. So yeah, just continue to make art.
Yeah. So one of the questions that I have for you that's kind of a more a smaller question, but also a rapid fire question, is what are some of the, or what is the most worrying trends or things that you've encountered in the industry lately that worries you? Or
inspiration. Artists saying that I've been inspired by this other artist, but when at the end of the day, you really just copy what somebody else worked really hard to do.
Yeah.
That's actual authenticity.
Yeah. Do you feel that it's important for artists to have one style?
I think it's important for artists to feel like they're doing good work. And I think when asked that question, I often tell an artist, there are some people who do many styles well, and there are some people who do one thing very well. Mm-hmm. Know which one you are. Yeah. Because there's some artists who are considered generalists, and I hate that word because it sounds very plain and boring, but yeah. they do amazing work across a number of different styles. And there are some artists who do one style so phenomenally well. And then there are some who go from being a generalist to being a specific artist, and from being a specific artist to being a generalist. I don't think there's any one route to go through. You'll know it when you start doing your work. And if it's good work.
So let me ask the question in a different way. Would you not represent someone because they work in many styles, for example?
No. Okay. No, I would definitely rep people who work in different styles.
Yeah. Okay. So that's not like something that sends a warning sign or.
No, yes. Not at all. And I think actually I point to Velvet Spectrum, one of the mm-hmm. artists that I rep as a point mm-hmm. of reference. He's yeah. got he's got a number of different things that he does within his work. And I view his work as his style. You know, yeah, within each yeah. different, like he'll do type and lettering, he'll do animation, he'll do kind of like trippy patterns and color work. But within all of it, I think as long as it all still looks like you, you're in good shape. Like it's still, you know, you're still, your style, it's such a strange, style is such a strange word.
Yeah.
Because I think it can be limiting and it can also be kind of freeing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So here are some more fun questions now that we've gotten all the more stressful negative stuff also, but also interesting. So like, do you have artists that inspire you that could be like past or current?
Oh yeah. I mean, when I was younger and to this day, I still like almost tear up at Jean-Michel Basquiat's work.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
it's had a massive influence on me, uh-huh. And both just his story, but all, and his work, and there is just so much to be seen in the work, and there's so many messages, both hidden, both literal and figurative, and then the use of color and line. I don't think I will ever get over his work.
Yeah,
the Baroque period is just always fascinated me.
The
ability the sculpture mostly
uh-huh
but yeah just through the way that to think back when it was made also and the detail to the human form I always just found fascinating and been very jealous of that ability to do that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's cool. Do you have favorite books? It could be related to art or not?
You know, I have a couple of recent reads that I'd rather talk about than favorite books,
because
it's so hard to pick one.
Absolutely.
I'm a huge history buff, uh-huh. and I've been, having lived in New York for 20 years now, I'm really obsessed with the beginnings of New York. And I started uh-huh. reading Island at the Center of the World by Russell Shorto, uh-huh. and then got into all of his books after that, Revolution Song, I think the other one's Amsterdam. But he writes about a lot of the early Dutch and British colonization of Manhattan. And it's just fascinating, the history behind this state and this country, all starting really with that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's really cool.
And then the other one I was reading was Killers of the Paper Moon or Flower Moon. It's the beginnings of the FBI. I find history really interesting.
Well, that's cool. I used to be a historian, so that's
interesting. Awesome.
Yeah. There's some great books about the history.
I might have to pick your brain about some more to read.
yeah. I can give you some recommendations. So do you have favorite movies?
I know I'm just going to get torn apart for this. Goonies was a movie that I saw when I was a kid, and
that's funny,
the spirit of Mikey, the main character in that movie, and the idea of a friend group. Again, uh-huh. being queer and, you know, having what we call our chosen families, that idea of friend group and you can do it and stick together, like, always resonated with me since a kid. And Never Ending Story, the huge fantasy and the effects at that time were just so awesome. And like the practicality of like those costumes, uh-huh. those are two hugely influential movies for me. Girls.
Yeah, no, I have great affection from some movies that I watched when I was a child. I think that's, it can be of great comfort even when you grow up sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have favorite podcasts?
Yeah, I tend to listen to either comedy or industry stuff.
Oh, cool.
For comedy, I love Late Night Whenever with Michelle Buteau.
Okay.
She's hilarious.
Yeah, I've never heard that one.
I saw her stand up and then started listening to her podcast. And I can't, it's just, it's so good, vulgar, funny, kind of like, it's awful. Some of this stuff she says is amazing.
Uh-huh.
And then I really like Overshare. Which is hosted by one of the co-founders of Working Not Working.
Yeah.
Justin Janak, I think, is, I always pronounce his last name wrong. I feel so
terrible. Yeah.
But Overshare is really good for, I would say, any freelancer in the business or thinking of getting into the business. It gives a lot of good insight.
Cool. So, with that, I want to thank you for your time and. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me. I love the show, and I think a lot of people would benefit from listening to it. And what you're doing is great, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. That's super kind.
That was my conversation with Matthew LeBaron. Links to everything we talked about and the comprehensive show notes will be on the website at illustrationhour.com/LeBaron. If this information helped you, please consider letting Matthew and I know and share the podcast with others. I would really appreciate it. I really like this format and letting you submit questions directly, so I might be incorporating this more into some future episodes. As always, if you have thoughts, ideas, or questions you'd like to see answered on the show, please reach out to me. You can find me on Instagram at IllustrationHour, on Twitter at IHpod, or you can shoot me an email at illustrationhourpodcast@gmail.com. That's it for me this week. Thank you so much for listening, and have a good and creative week.